Hello. Wow, it feels so weird to be talking with you or to you in the podcast way. This has been such a long time since I've done this in an expressive way or a personal way. So please excuse the audio. I figured it out, just not all the old tools I used to use are working with my new Mac, my audio interface. So I just felt like doing this and, you know, going at it. But, I was among the first wave of podcasters, and I almost feel like I should have a clean intro, an intro song, stuff like that. And as I listen to a couple podcasts recently, they all sound like, I guess, even when we started podcasting back in the day, like a long time ago, it seems, it's only been like 10, 12 years, maybe, I don't know, 15 years that I did my first podcast. And we were imitating major media or college radio. So we'd have theme songs and do all the stuff that the major media, typical media would do. And then this is we're supposed to be part of this new media revolution, and evolution is slow, right? So you can hear me fiddling with things now. But I felt like it should just be me talking to you. Like that's how I want to do this. I just want to do it in a genuine, well, I shouldn't say genuine, because I'm sure there's people that are having their podcasts and they have cool intro songs and even theme songs, as I once did. I just want to do it in a, you know, I don't know what to call it. But today, I'm introducing my first podcast, I guess, in a long time. I did an interview with J.B. Ross. He's a Chicago legend and probably an entertainment legend, but I'm not in the horrible entertainment business. But J.B. Ross was James Brown's lawyer, one of James Brown's lawyers. He's worked with, Ray Charles. He's a great Chicago legend. He really helped all the, he helped out all the adult bookstores. He was a adamant defender of free speech. And he also helped get a lot of the old blues artists money out of people like, I believe, Led Zeppelin or whoever was fucking them around. Jay would chase after people and make sure they got paid. And anyway, he's always been a fascinating guy, and he's helped me out and helped me out for free many times. So how can I not like him? I mean, he's been just fucking, you know, cool. And he's helped me out with a lot of events that have needed help when I lived in Chicago. And, he's just been a great guy. You have to excuse all my andums, and this is, like I said, the first time in a long time I've done this. I think I've written this in the notes to the video and stuff like this. I have written this in the notes in the video. Jay was a person that I went to. I could talk to any, like I said, he helped me out. And I could talk about anything. And I did this book, Might is Right. And I did it, well, there's a, I did it while I was interviewing a white supremacist in Canada. He sent me the book, Might is Right. And at the same time, my wife had given me the Satanic Bible. And when I read that, I was reading them at the same time, and they were both the same book. It was interesting. So anyway, I published, this is a long story, and I'll get into this in a, I'm writing some explanations as to what I've done, and trying to put that out in a book in the next year or so. But when I did that, there was a lot of heat, and well, I got a lot of heat, but besides that, there were a lot of questions I had about some of these things that folks would be, like the white supremacist guys would say, the Jews run the media, the Jews run the media. So one day I just had the gall to ask J.B. Ross, Hey, Jay, do the Jews run the media? And he went on with this great long history of the of Jewish folks in the entertainment business. And me and my wife, Amy, were always impressed with that conversation. And once in a while, this conversation will come up with conspiracy theorists and lunatics, and I don't think they're the same. And folks would talk about the Jews running the media, and we try to explain Jay's side of things, but it just is not anything we can do as great as Jay can do. So, you know, 10, 15 years later, I get the chance. You know, it's always been bugging me. I wish I had recorded it when he told me the story. So recently I passed through Chicago, and I was able to ask him, do the Jews run the media? I should say, do Jews run the media, right? And he answered. And so this is, you know, he answered on video, and this is the long form of it. I'll have a video. I have the video up as well. And so, yeah, I thought it was great. I think it's a great answer. Well, it's a historic answer. It's accurate. It seems to be accurate. But what do I know? I love Jay's. I can listen to Jay talk for days. He's a really cool and interesting character. And I really love the guy. And he's writing stories on his Facebook. Find him on Facebook. He's writing these great little stories, almost like he's writing his memoirs. And always interesting stories. He's just a smart, brilliant, great person. Really loving guy. I don't know. I really like Jay. J.B. Ross. Chicago lawyer extraordinaire. So, here you go. Enjoy. And remember, this is audio from Shane Bugby.com. That's me. It's so weird to pronounce my name as my, like, this is my website. It should be like, you know, thepodcastticket.com or I don't know, right? But I just decided to go with my name. I think that's the future of a lot of this mumbo jumbo too, is just people have their own, just like you have a phone number, you have your name. And on your, you know, this is where I'm at, ShaneBugby.com, and this is what I do. And if you go to the website, you'll see I have probably 150 podcasts up there from old days. I have a 24-hour podcast that's was the first podcast I did. I think, yeah, the first podcast I did with my wife and a guy I'm friends with here sometimes. And so that's a good, yeah, anyway, go to my website, ShaneBugby.com, if you want more information or more listening, and enjoy J.B. Ross. Thank you.
I mean, if you want to read a good book, read Jews, God, and History, and it shows you the amazing part that the Greeks played in the Jewish religion, and ultimately in all religions, and how Western religions, and what the Romans were all about. It's really not just about that, but essentially. The concept was that in early Christianity, money lending, tax collecting, were forbidden for the Christians. You know what I mean? It was just totally inappropriate stuff. And the only group that was allowed to exist outside the Christians were the Jews. And they were deprived of being, you know, artisans. I mean, there was no... You know, until last 200 years, there were no Jewish artists because they couldn't do it. You know, they weren't allowed. The only thing they were allowed to do for 1,000 years was to be a tax collecting and money lendings, things like that. So you figure, you know, 1,000 years of doing the same thing, people wind up getting to do it pretty well. So The Muslims, especially, who were turned out by and large were kinder to the Jews than the Christians were, the Muslims would invite them into their countries to help pick up the economy. Of course, then they would, you know, get jealous and take all their stuff and kick them out, you know. But that we've been doing that for years. You heard the story about Mr. Goldberg's visit with God, didn't you ever hear that one?
No.
Oh, yeah, he was elected as a representative of the Jewish people on earth to have an audience with God. They rush him in, and they said, God is very busy, but he'll see you for a few minutes. He says, but please, you know, be quick. He says, no, I just have one question to ask him. And then he meets God, and he says, God, I'm a representative of the Jewish people on earth. He says, and I have just one question for you. And God says, yes. He says, is it true that we, the Jewish people, are the chosen people? And God says, you waste my time with that? Of course that's true. Everyone knows that. He says, well, then we do have one favor to ask. And God says, yes, what is it? And Mr. Goldberg said, could you please choose somebody else for a change?
I shouldn't laugh so hard. My camera shook as I'm laughing. That's just funny. Oh. Well, that's good.
Yeah. But that's kind of where it's at. Anyway, what else? What else do you want to talk about?
So, do the Jews run the media? That's what we were talking about. That's
considering
the original.
Considering that they're only 1 or 2% of the population, they have had, up till recently, an unusually high influence in the media because that was the door that was open to them. You know, in this United States, for example, what they knew well from Europe, the Rothschilds and all that, banking, they weren't allowed to participate in the banking business in the United States. That was totally, they were more or less blackballed from it. And so when this new Nickelodeon thing started at the turn of the last century, it was considered a fad, you know, never lasts, nothing. And a lot of the Jews, you know, some of them were cigar makers, like Samuel Goldwyn was in the cigar business and this and that. They invested some money in it because they were allowed to. And it just grew and grew and grew. They happened to hit on the right thing. And so a lot of their people, you know, got into that business. It's just similar to the Greeks in restaurants. You know what I mean? They got into restaurants and, you know, up until recently, the majority of small restaurants were owned by people of Greek background. The Koreans in a dry cleaning place now. You know what I mean? Certain ethnic groups seem to gravitate towards certain businesses. But now, of course, there are no American-owned major record companies. Warner is purchased by the Russians, and the Japanese and Germans have gotten together with Sony BMG, you know, to celebrate World War II, and they control that one. Universal is Perrier Water, and you know, from France, and a few other investors. So, you know, there are no American companies there. As far as motion picture is concerned, a lot of the, you know, I mean, Paley started CBS. He was Jewish. He's long gone. You know, and now you have people like Rupert Murdoch, you know, arch conservative. He owns one of the four major channels. And you have, Sarnoff started NBC, and that's now combined with Universal, and, you know, and stuff like that. So while there's still a lot of people of Jewish background involved, it certainly wasn't as bad as it was for Walt Disney when he was there, because he became a notorious anti-Semite, and probably with a little bit of justification, because he was like one of the only Christians in Hollywood in a position of studio owner, you know what I mean? And because Jews were denied admission to country clubs and stuff like that, you know, he didn't hang with them. You know, he was, you know, differently. I think he had Ed Wynn in Mary Poppins. Ed Wynn in Mary Poppins, and I think Sergeant Garcia and Zorro. I think that's about the only two Jewish guys he ever employed. You know, not too favorable.
I know there was another, now that we're talking, there was another part of our conversation that went into how every person, you know, it had to do with suffering and comedy. And it had to do with, I was just like blown away by every comedian that just blows my mind is Jewish. And well, I figured I was true. Wondering how, for true. Me it is, for all my favorite ones are Jewish, and I was wondering, like, how would I even relate to them beyond the point of only suffering, like, something like that.
Nowadays, the majority of the comedians that are coming up these days are black. You know what I mean? They've taken, you know, Russell Simmons did a lot by bringing a bunch of black comedians out on pay cable. And so now I would say that's more. The Jews did have their influence. I mean, when you're a victim of suffering and persecution and stuff like that, you need laughter in order to alleviate, you know, stop from going crazy. In the midst of the Holocaust, there was humor. You know, in the concentration camps, there was humor. I mean, it wasn't stand-up or anything like that, but people still made jokes because it's the only way to keep your sanity sometime. And when you're the victim of prejudice day in and day out, you know, it happens. Even look at the guy who, conservative, at least at that time he was known as a conservative, now by the Tea Party standards, probably a liberal, Goldwater, who was half Jewish, you know, told the joke about how he was asked to leave a country club swimming pool because they didn't allow Jews, and his response was, well, I'm only half Jewish, can I go into my waist? You know what I mean? You know, stuff like that. And of course, he was Episcopalian. He lost, but you know, he became more and more liberal as he got older, and they disowned him, more or less.
Comedians are the other side of the serial killers. Like, the serial killers are introverts, and comedians are extroverts, because they go through the same kind of, you know, they're hard times, and you know, at some point they crack, and one becomes a stand-up comedian, one becomes a, you know, a crazy killer. That's
well, I necessarily agree with you that they are necessarily extroverts. For example, a lot of people in show business are shy introverts who have developed the ability when they're on to feign being an extrovert. I mean, there's an old joke about Milton Berle that when he opened up the refrigerator and the light went on, he did 5 minutes. You know what I mean? So, I mean, and I've been with, I mean, I remember I had dinner with Phil Donahue once, who, if you ever remember his old talk show, was animated, jumping around, talking to this one and that one. And in person, at dinner, quiet, you know, not talking, listening. I mean, just the total opposite of his persona on television. And I think a lot of them are shy people who, you know, get into some kind of a mind frame where they, you know, let go. You know, and in that particular thing, they are acting as extroverts, but, you know, really aren't. I mean, I know, for example, trial lawyers who are just flamboyant and just, you know, and in person, quiet as, you know, boring, you know, things like that. So, you can take courses. It's all part of conditioning. You know, conditioning is where it's at. That's what you have to do. You condition yourself, and I remember when Tom Dreesen took me to the Tonight Show, and he said to me, he says, right here, he says, this is where comedians stand and face 30 million people, and it's decided whether they're going to be a success or not based on how well they do. This is the spot. And I said, well, you're on tonight. He was going to be one of his 100 visits to the Tonight Show. He says, you're on tonight. He says, yeah, I always come here and stand here first, condition myself, and prepare myself for it. You know, and so.
What do you mean by conditioning? Like, you're making a callous? Like,
well, in other
learning?
Words, if you've been through something, if you're more familiar with something, it's easier to deal with it. When I had to go in for an MRI, and, you know, in those days, an MRI, it's like they put you in a casket. It's almost like going into the grave. I was scared to death. It was terrible. Now I still have to take him occasionally. I can jump in, spend an hour, you know, totally immersed in it. Doesn't bother me a bit. I've been conditioned. My mother was afraid to fly. My dad was ill. She had to take him to Mayo Clinic. I took her to the airport. A friend of mine worked there. He took her into the plane. He gave her a tour, showed her the pilot's seat, everything like that. We arranged for a quick flight around the airport and back. She flew. The next week, she flew to Mayo's and no problem. You know, even though she was afraid. Conditioning. You take it a little bit at a time rather than get hit over the head with it.
You think it's just, it works the same way in the opposite, like fears, like fear of flying? You condition yourself to be afraid?
No. That comes naturally. I mean, it's a normal thing that, you know, you would be afraid of heights and things like that. I mean, that's just a self-protective mechanism within us. But, I mean, once you realize that it is safe and that you're okay and that more people are killed in automobile accidents than in planes, then eventually, you know, you get used to it. You know, and you don't have to look down either. No one's forcing you.
What's art, Jay? What is art? You represent a lot of artists. What is art? What is art? You make art. Yeah, you make art. You're an artist. Yeah, you make collages.
Well, what is art? I make collages and assemblages because it's cheaper than going to a shrink. And so that's a way of spending your time. I think it's a way of dealing with the world. In other words, you're trying to express yourself with your peers and with the world. You're trying to create something for whatever your motivation is. Some people, beauty, comedians, laughter, musicians. Until recently, it was to soothe people. Now, some of the music is to agitate people, you know. It's changed. Of course, in my opinion of music as it evolves, in pop music, etc., is that essentially the young people, you know, their music is designed to irritate the parents. So from every generation it gets, you know, I mean, in my generation, the four-letter words that they use now in the songs would have been an anathema. I mean, it would be unheard of. Now everybody's a this and a that, and it's blank you, and, you know, stuff like that. Nobody, you know, the kids don't think anything of it.
Boy, today's music to me is almost like conditioning them to be consumers or something. There's not a lot of, I don't see any message, but maybe I'm getting old. I'm missing out the young
music.
Let
me ask you this question. Do you remember the 50s?
Yeah, well, I don't remember them. I wasn't there, but I know some of the art from the 50s.
What was the message in Bebopalula, She's My Baby?
Get your dance on.
Oh, well, all right.
So get your freak on. Have fun. Get right. You know, and back then dancing was illegal in certain spots. Dirty dancing, whatever.
Are you kidding? I have a fellow who rents for me, etc., and I get to see his lifestyle. Since the invention, I mean, the biggest innovation of the 20th century has got to be the birth control pill. Because I see him, he's got at least two different women a day, and believe me, they're not talking. And it's every day, and he could teach a course in sex. It's just unbelievable. What I missed out on is unbelievable. And it's, you know, and they talk and they exchange pictures of private parts over the iPhones and stuff like that. And people are contacting him. I saw your picture on Facebook. You know, what do you like? You know, when could we get together? I mean, women have become extremely aggressive. And the whole idea of, and it's just a sexual world. They're all doing it with each other. And, I mean, I'm not complaining other than I was born too early, that's all.
But there's the influence of Bebop-a-loo-bop, but She's My Baby.
Well, it changes, I mean, it modifies. At the time of Bebop-a-loo-bop, She's My Baby, Ozzy and Harriet, who were married and had a television show, couldn't be seen in the same bed together, even though they really were married. And Lucy, when she got pregnant, was considered to be in a family way, not pregnant, you see. But it has deteriorated, especially with this internet, so that the kids can see pornography and they can see sexual activities and everything. And they're emulating it, younger and younger and stuff like that. It looks like fun.
It kills me. It put me out. I published obscene books. I used to have a for sure niche.
Yeah.
You know, it's a band somewhere. Yeah. I'll publish it. Well, now the obscenity's gone. You know, it's all over the internet. Plug in whatever you want. You find it.
Yeah, I mean, there's practically nothing that you can't see there. It's amazing.
Right.
I was the one who made a deal with the city of Chicago to allow adult bookstores to exist here. That was something I did when I was younger, and I was very gung-ho First Amendment. I didn't particularly like the books, but I thought adults should be able to read whatever they want.
Jay, you've defended and helped me out plenty.
Oh, did I?
Yeah, for all those obscene books, the events I did.
What? My memory is so bad, I don't even remember.
Well, you helped a lot. I mean, it was great. Well,
I was never a big fan of them, but I just felt that, you know, people should be able to read what they want, especially if it doesn't hurt anybody. So we made a deal with the city. No sex with animals. No child pornography where children are forced into compromising situations. And
let's face it, in the 70s, you had child pornography was at bookstores. You'd see it on greeting cards, cards.
No question about it. It existed. But my deal that all the bookstores here accepted was no prosecutions on anything as long as, and no graphic pictures in the window. All these stores are, you know, look very neutral. There's nothing, things that would gross somebody out, you know, in the window, etc. Those three things were what we agreed to, and in exchange, they stopped prosecuting and saved themselves millions of dollars in prosecution. I never forget the case that I had that kind of brought it about. This guy was an unemployment compensation, and he went to the state, and they suggested a place for him to get a job. And of course, when they do that, you have to apply, and if you're offered the job, you have to take it, or you're off unemployment compensation. So he went, and it was Weird Harold's adult bookstore. Well, the guy went to work for him. Within a week, he was the charges, and we started talking how to work this out.
That's great. That's one.
It's not, they were going to honor me on one of my birthdays, etc., you know, with a plaque from a proclamation from the city. And when they found out that I was the one who, you know, my efforts resulted in this, they wouldn't do it. So the city, I don't know whether they missed the money that they would be making from these prosecutions or whatever, but I wasn't too popular. I even debated Alderman Burke on the pre-Oprah show about it, you know, and it was pretty even, too. We were doing pretty good. About obscenity. I was for allowing it for adults, and Burke was for dismissing it completely. And then they got a guy named Joe Biden, I think. Joe... Somebody, a guy from the back of the yards. And he had solved the problem of obscene magazines. So they brought him on, and everyone's waiting to see, how did he solve the problem? And they said, well, what did you do? Joe Meegan, that was his name. He said, how did you solve it? He says, we don't allow any magazines to be sold. That's how we solved it. I said, how can you argue with that?
Yeah, that's a solution.
Yeah.
Is there such a thing as artistic sellout? Like, you know, some people say, oh, that guy's a sellout, or someone says, I feel like a sellout. It's just...
Well, I mean, sometimes you have to make compromises. I wrote a children's book about tolerance, and I'm working with a... it's very hard to get published and even find a literary agent. So I found a literary agent, and she wants to change it from a picture book to a written book and raise the level of this. By the time she was through with it, it's no longer the book I did. It's not my concept. So I'm really thinking, do I want to put this book out? It's better than not doing it at all. Or, you know, do I just want to die with it and just say, you know, be a purist? So I don't know, I haven't decided. Probably I'll put it out, you know, as modified. But, you know, you have to make compromises because you have to deal with other people. most big projects like movies and stuff like that, you know, it's not a one-man job. You know, even Woody Allen and Mel Brooks, when they do their things, which are essentially their ideas, they have to rely on other people too.
So is that there's no such thing as artistic sellout?
I think there is artistic sellout, but I compromise? Think it goes with the territory.
Okay.
You know, in other words, the only people that can be totally in control are people who are doing fine artwork, you know, and decide what they want. But even then, they have to, you know, the guy, for example, realistic paintings, paintings that are totally realistic, like the James Brown one I have back there, you know, those aren't as popular these days as stuff that's more, you know, impressionistic or expressionistic or, you know, just, you know, Picasso-ish or whatever. That seems to be more of interest. So somebody who's as talented as the guy who can make something that almost looks like a photograph does not do as well financially as somebody who, like Jason Pollock, who threw paint on canvas and then cut it up, you know, and that was his artwork. You figure it.
Ken Nordine was talking to me about that when I called him about Pollock, and he said he was started with an ad agency. An ad guy said, here, do this. Why don't you just do this? And he did that and became popular.
Well, Ken has a thing where he says that he has a vignette in one of his records, Confessions of, and then he puts the Social Security number, and he tells his story of how he started out. And it's really worth listening to. And one of my favorite line is, he says, I discovered the secret. He says that everybody likes themselves better than they like you. He says, and if you want them to like you, you better be like them. So he says, I was Democrat with the Democrats. I was Republican with the Republicans. He says, I was independent with the disinterested. And everybody, you know, my tie began to look like everybody else's tie, and they admired my good taste, you know, and he goes on and on, you know. So there's something to be said about that. You know, you have to deal with other people, and people tend to be interested in themselves first.
Thank you for listening. And if you'd like more, go to ShaneBugby.com. Hey, that's me. ShaneBugby.com.